opinions expressed here are those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in this program.
Well, hello again. This is Jim Newman, KCIW Radio, presenting another episode in our veteran community. An expose, if you will, on the people who make up a very important fabric of our community. So today, I have the honor of talking to Hank Cunningham, who is a relatively newbie in town as things go. But he's an easy guy to talk to. I talked to him on the phone yesterday, and he said, yeah, I'll come down and hang out with you for an hour and tell you a little bit about myself. So, Hank, welcome to the radio program. I hope you're going to enjoy this.
Well, thanks, Jim. I'm honored to be here. Thank you.
Yeah. Hank has quite a few contacts in the community amongst the interviewees I've already done. And we're finding out in more conversation how small of a world it is as far as overlapping times in Vietnam and things like that. But we'll get to that a little bit later on. So, Hank, we're going to go into the Wayback Machine. And we're going to go back to when you was born. Okay, so where, when?
Well, I was born in Seattle, Washington in 1946, which makes me old.
A little bit older than me, but not by much. Now, where in Seattle were you born?
North Seattle, an area called Ballard, which is quite yuppified these days. In those days, it was very low-income fishermen, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of drunks on the street. It wasn't a real nice place.
It wasn't a tourist mecca, I guess.
Not then. Well, now it is.
Yeah, of course. Well, the reason why I ask is because I was born in the Navy Hospital in Bremerton. Back
oh, really?
In 52, yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, so yeah. Kind of akin, just a few years ahead of me. So
both my parents, they were both World War II veterans, Army Air Corps. So very familiar with the VA hospital there in Seattle.
Yeah, great. Good deal. So how long did you stay in the Seattle area growing up?
Well, I went through high school, graduated from Ballard High School, and I'm a big fan of community college because I love to go back and then forward. After getting out of the service, I had no college at all before being drafted at 19 years old. And when I got back, I went to community college, Shoreline College, which is in North Seattle, and that's what got me through. I never thought I was college material, really. I was very working class, lower, I wouldn't even say lower middle class, but
upper lower class.
Upper lower class, probably. But a very unmotivated student, and I was more concerned with making a buck and working odd jobs. And then I did graduate from high school, and then first job I got was working as a warehouseman and driver and down in the waterfront area of South Seattle, and was in the Teamsters Union. You couldn't even set foot on the floor of the warehouse until you joined the Teamsters Union.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And so I spent a year and a half or so doing that until inevitably I was drafted.
Mm-hmm.
And I entered the Army in April of 66. At that time, I know Ray Gary was on one of your shows, and they were drafting into the Marine Corps also at that time. So I thought, it looked to me as about 50-50, was I going to go in the Army or the Marine Corps? So ended up in the Army and was inducted in Seattle, and then figured I would go to Fort Lewis, which was, you know, maybe 45 minutes away.
Right, just down the road.
But no, they sent us to, flew us down to Fort Ord, California, which is no longer an Army base. I think there's still some military there. But so remember going into a barracks, first getting my head shaved, and then going into a old wooden barracks at Fort Ord, and arrived with a busload of, I got my first orders then, drill sergeant, or reacted like a drill sergeant, jumped on the bus and told us what was what and how low we were.
You maggots.
evolutionary scale of human beings.
I was
only there about a week, and there was a big spinal meningitis scare going around at the time. So they sent all of us who were inducted there various places, and I wound up at Fort Riley, Kansas, and that's where I had my basic training. And that was pretty uneventful, very cold in Kansas, even in April, much colder than Seattle. So I did my basic training there. And then after basic training, they put you in specialized schools called AIT, Advanced Infantry Training, I think that stands for. And
is that where you become more like intelligent cannon fodder or what?
That's the way it was looking to me. I felt lucky that I didn't go into the Marine Corps. Hey, they give you a whole battery of tests when you first come in the service. Remember, this is 1966, and they weren't drafting people with master's degrees. Let me put it that way. So I came out, I'm a fairly average, maybe a little bit average intelligence. But in that group, I was higher up. And so there's a joke, you might have heard it with in relation to the show MASH on TV, where those of us who had somewhat higher scores ended up, well, first they ask if you want to go to officer candidate school.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't, because I would have had to stay in the Army for an extra year. And I really thought, I figured I'd be a second lieutenant infantry platoon, and you know what happened to a lot of them.
Oh yeah.
And no, I didn't want to go to OCS. So the next thing was the joke from MASH was either make you a clerk or a medic. So I was assigned to go to medic training at Fort Sam Houston, Texas. And so by that time, what would it have been? Basic training was 8 or 10 weeks, and then so by the summer, I was in San Antonio, Texas, and I had grown up in Seattle. I don't like really hot weather, and let me tell you, the summer in San Antonio is super hot.
Right. Okay. So what I'm going to do is we're going to leave you in San Antonio because you made another reference to Seattle, and I kind of wanted to get back to a little bit more of your early days. So elementary school, what memories or takeaways from that first 8 years of your education experience do you have?
Well, I went to elementary school in the Ballard area of Seattle. It has very old brick school, Whittier Elementary School. And I don't remember. I remember there was one black kid in an entire class. So I didn't really see another African-American, basically. Well, I saw them, but I was never really in close contact with African-Americans until I was in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew nothing about that.
Right. Really. You know, neighborhoods were pretty much segregated, and even at that stage, according to your ethnicity, you know, whether you're Italian or, you know, a black or Hispanic and stuff like that. And it was like something that happened naturally. They, you know, your particular type attracted, you know, the new people in town, and that's where you were.
Well, I was even a little bit out of the ordinary, because almost all the kids I went to school with all the way through high school were Scandinavian. Swedish or Norwegian. Their fathers were fishermen, and so I knew lots of Petersons and Svensons and Olsons, and I can remember, you know, kids are always getting in fights. I could just remember some big Swede having me in a headlock and pounding on me. So they're big people.
Oh, yeah. Big bone.
So anyway, that was my very early childhood experience.
Any high school sweethearts or crushes that you had back then?
Well, and then moving on, then junior high school was also in the Ballard area. My mother died when I was 14.
Uh-huh.
So when I was in junior high school, and I got in some trouble then, was in a stolen car, and we were in an accident, and I was almost killed in a head-on collision in a stolen car. I wasn't driving. Oh, a friend of mine was driving. So that's how things got off to kind of a rocky start. My dad, if you're going to have a single parent, you're better off with your mother, I'll put it that way.
For the most part, probably.
best to have an intact family with both parents, but right. It was just me and my dad until the time I was 17, 18, when I got out of high school, and then I just went off on my own, lived with some friends, and that's when I started working as a warehouseman down the waterfront and joined the Teamsters Union. I didn't stay in the warehouse job the whole time I was there. I was promoted. This was a canned food company, and I was promoted to be a merchandiser. Merchandiser in those days would go out and at the end aisles of grocery stores, they'd stack up cans, sure, and make these displays and mm-hmm. hang signs for sale. So I fully intended when I got back, how they did have to guarantee your job back when mm-hmm. you got out, if you were drafted, or maybe even any military. And so I assumed I'd come back and I would be a merchandiser, just like a sales trainee, basically. Figured I'd have a career working as a salesman in the wholesale foods industry.
Right.
Which would have been okay with me. Sure. I would have thought that was just fine. Well, it's not, obviously, that's not how things turned out.
Right. Now, you're making, I would assume for the time, fairly decent money because it's a unionized kind of position. So you got a little bit better pay than most people. Is that an accurate observation? Or?
Well, wasn't a lot, but yeah.
Yeah.
It was, the union pay was better than what some
right.
uneducated or undereducated 18, 19-year-olds would be making, but not a lot of money.
And I realize that a lot of the 18, 19-year-old guys had particular interests like cars. Were you into cars at all? Or?
Oh, not. I had other friends who were much more mechanical than I was and mm-hmm. am, who had fancy 55 Chevys and things like that. I just had an old Ford to begin with. I remember it was a 50 Ford. Mm-hmm. I loved it because it made a lot of noise. It was a stick shift with flathead 8
right,
engine,
right.
You know, and it was very loud and very unreliable. I remember always changing flat tires in the car. But,
oh, boy.
Yeah, so, and then you ask girls. Yeah, I had a girlfriend or two, and I was not married before I went into the okay. Army, so it was nothing. There's one, ironically, back from those days that I just reestablished contact with on Facebook.
Oh, really?
And she reminded me of letters that we exchanged when I was in Vietnam. And,
yeah, those letters were a lifesaver for a lot of the veterans over there.
I did get letters from her and from my grandmother. Uh-huh. Don't remember ever getting a letter from my father, but that figures. Like I say, had my mother still been alive, she would have written to me.
Right. Now, were you able to recapture your relationship with your dad in subsequent years, or was there always kind of a rift in there?
It was always strained.
Yeah.
I would say he was an alcoholic, and he had lost his wife, who was definitely the stronger partner in that marriage. And so he and I were always kind of at odds.
Right. All right. Well, that's
but good. He remarried after I was back. And so I did see, and sometimes I would stay with he and my stepmother.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it wasn't total alienation.
Oh,
but,
no,
yeah.
no. We yeah, weren't estranged cool. or anything cool. like that.
Yeah. I want to touch also on, you brought up something about OCS and, you know, going in for testing and stuff like that. Not a lot of people are aware that there was something called McNamara's Morons going on, where they were actually enlisting people with IQs below 85. And it's a big controversy. There's actually a book written about that, and I first heard about it through my brother-in-law. And it was pretty amazing because they just needed bodies. They really didn't care if they functioned. They just needed bodies.
Well, because of all that testing, I know what my IQ is.
Yeah.
it's way above 85.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't want to say what it is, but I wouldn't have even known what my IQ was had it not been for the battery of tests that they put you through when you're first in the Army.
Yeah, so it was interesting how the testing runs the gamut of everything. And, of course, thankfully you didn't choose to become a second lieutenant because their fragging rates were pretty high.
Yeah, pretty high attrition rate, and I saw a few of them bite the dust.
Yeah, okay.
Some of whom, if you want to call it friendly fire or whatever.
It was fire of unknown origin.
Yeah.
So you're down in Texas. You're going to Corpsman school, right? Is that where?
Yeah, medic school. I forget exactly what it was called. Yeah,
right.
Corpsmen are in the Navy, and medics are in the Army.
Yeah, okay, gotcha.
Corpsmen are much better trained than Army medics, I think. My friend Ray would probably agree.
That's funny. So, how long of a program was that?
Oh, I think that was 10 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And they trained you for all kinds of things that never happened. If somebody got shot on the street here and had a sucking chest wound,
mm-hmm.
I would know just what to do.
Right.
Did I ever see a sucking chest wound in Vietnam? For that matter, I wasn't in infantry. I was in armored cavalry. Mostly what I saw were shrapnel wounds, but not really any even gunshot wounds. Shrapnel and, sometimes whatever came off that.
Yeah. Sure, sure. Yeah, so it was like burns,
burns and gashes. Big open wounds. Yeah,
yeah.
Not like a gunshot wound.
It's like I need two or three hands here just to hold this guy.
Yeah.
Together.
Yeah, kind of had to find the largest bandage you could find, and or your shirt or whatever.
Right, and hopefully enough painkiller to keep the guy.
Well, that didn't come till later, but well, there was morphine right there, but more often than not, I was in forward base camps. And we would just be, they always taught you in medic school, stop the bleeding, clear the airway. There was a third thing, which I don't remember. I remember those two things. Those are probably the most important. But it was just to get them patched up and then get them on a evac helicopter.
Right.
And those were essential. That's why there were as few KIAs, relatively speaking, as it were, was because the medical evacuation was quite advanced
mm-hmm.
at that time. Way better than like World War II or even Korea.
Yeah.
Definitely. Especially better than World War II.
So how did you get from Texas over to Vietnam, transportation-wise?
Well, then after, they call that AIT, the medic training, they would send you to advanced, I forget exactly what it was called, advanced infantry training. So what do they do? Here we're going to Vietnam, they send us back to Fort Riley, Kansas. And they had set up these little jungle kind of like with hooches and stuff. And
right.
So it kind of looked like a village in Vietnam once I was there in Vietnam. I thought, oh, yeah, that was a reasonable facsimile of, of a village in Vietnam. And then you would get more, it was called jungle training. Do a lot of things that supposedly were going to happen to you, but never did. Now, I was in the infantry then, so I was looking forward to being an infantry medic is where I thought I was going to end up. And then I got to Vietnam and went over on a troop ship. And like I say, that was the worst month of my year tour of duty. It was horrible. You were stacked like sardines. These are old converted World War II luxury liners, and the bunks were stacked about 10 or 12 high, and you'd have to climb up into your bunk. And I am claustrophobic to this day.
Mm.
Climb up into your bunk, and then you'd have to get up every few hours and do guard duty up on top of on the deck of the ship. So anyway, it took 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks. Stopped in Okinawa, one stop on the way over, and I tell you, I had never been out on the ocean. We didn't see land for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And I'm not Navy. That's the furthest thing from what I would have wanted. And So finally, we end up in Vietnam off the coast, and it was like we had all our gear with us. You know, I don't know how many, probably 75 pounds of gear, including our rifle and all this other stuff. There's a book, very good book about Vietnam called The Things They Carried. And I thought the author of that book did a great job of bringing those of us who were there, bringing us back just by the kind of things that we had. And on the cover of the book, I remember, and even at the Vietnam Vets Memorial, the second one in Washington, D.C., it shows a helmet, steel pot helmet, which we use for everything, bathing, you name it.
Shaving, bathing, cooking.
And they had these kind of canvas camouflage covers over them, and there was an elastic band. And so you, the things they carried related to things that you put in the elastic band, little four packs of cigarettes, little toilet paper rolls.
Chewing gum, if you were lucky to have
it. I suppose, yeah. It seemed like everybody smoked in those days. But so that's a good book. That's a good book for anybody who wants to get a feel for what it was like being a soldier or grunt. So anyway, I got the ship is off the coast of Vung Tau, which is in the southern part of what was then South Vietnam, south of Saigon, and got off the, had to climb off the side of the ship, you know, just like in the movies on these,
using the big netting,
these rope nets. Yeah. You got a 75 pound pack on your back. I don't like heights.
You're claustrophobic.
There's so many things. I was assuming, and then onto these LST, these landing craft. And I assumed we were going to be getting shot at, you know, like
an invasion of Normandy or something.
Normandy invasion or sands of Iwo Jima or something. And it had all these kind of movie references to war. Well, it turns out Vung Tau was a resort, a French resort city. And so the LSTs, we come on to shore, and here's these tourists, most of whom were, I assume they were French. They're kind of, oh, hi, they're waving.
And that's the age of the bikini, so you probably saw a few of those on the beach.
So there we were. We hit land in Vietnam, and then convoyed up to either Ben Hoa or Long Ben, I forget which is a huge base camp there. And it's almost like a processing center. Now, it's not far from Saigon. But I was really never in Saigon until I was on my way out of country.
Now, what were your first experiences, keeping in mind you've been on a troop transport for 3 to 4 weeks? So you definitely had sea legs about you. What do you remember from stepping onto firm ground?
Well, I remember my legs felt rubbery, and it was just very odd, surreal kind of experience. Didn't know what I was expecting. We were going to be right away. We were going to be in battle. Again, I was still in the 9th Infantry, so you know, I didn't know what to expect, really. Are they just going to put us in platoons and send us out into the jungle or what? Well, as it turned out, they sent us to Long Bend, to these, this huge base camp. And then at that point, I was what they called infused. They were sending people all different places.
That sounds so nice. I'm infused.
I was infused into an armored cavalry unit, 11th Armored Cav. And they,
I liked the realistic term a little bit better. My ass was dropped off in the cavalry unit.
Well, it sounded better to me than being, you know, an infantry medic.
Right.
And I don't know that it was, but given where we ended up, so we were there for, I don't know, I was in Long Bend for, seemed like a month. It wasn't that long. And off we went. I joined the 11th Armored Cav in a place called Swan Lock. We then convoyed basically up the coast all the way to Chu Lai. Chu Lai is about 50 kilometers south of Da Nang, just as a point of reference, way north of Saigon. So we went up Highway 1 all the way up
there. Yeah, that's the Ho Chi Minh Trail, Highway 1?
No.
Oh.
Well,
In the northern part, maybe.
Well, the Ho Chi Minh Trail is really coming in from Laos and Cambodia. Okay. So it's a highway, kind of. The highway one.
For oxen carts.
More or less follows the coast. It's not right on the coast.
Gotcha, all right.
Yeah, so it's like the major highway in what was then Vietnam. So that was the first time I encountered landmines and things like that, but nothing too serious. Just as another point of reference, Chu Lai was near My Lai, and you may remember
heard of
the My Lai Massacre, which was the AmeriCal division, which was an army unit. And we were there, that was just before that happened. I'd have to check the dates. Never was with them. We were usually, if anything, closer to Marine units. I replaced Marine units with Korean Marines and along the coast. And that's in what they called I Corps, which is a Roman numeral 1.
Right.
But they called it I Corps, which included Da Nang and all the way up to Hue and all the rest of what was then South Vietnam. And so, you know, there were bad places to be in Vietnam. One would have been down in the Mekong Delta where I started out. And the other was I Corps.
Hmm.
So I was fortunate enough, to end up in that part of the country. And then we would be in forward base camps. We would often go out on search, what they called search and destroy missions. And being in the armored cav, we jokingly called them search and be destroyed.
Yeah.
They could hear us coming a mile away. And our cav unit has armored personnel, carriers, tanks with 90-millimeter guns, 50-caliber machine guns, and they're very loud. Later on in the war, after I was gone, they were frequently ambushed. We really did not. I think they were, at that point, they hadn't figured out that it was really easy to ambush an armor unit.
Right.
And to take them out. And that's what they did later. I did not experience that. But we'd go out on search and destroy missions, and we'd be in the middle of the jungle and sometimes go through defoliated zone. So everybody was there.
Agent Orange, yay.
Everybody that was there was, that was in the field.
Yeah.
Was exposed to Agent Orange.
Yeah.
You know, we would go through these areas and then we'd get an order, okay, free fire zone. So, I mean, we had so much weaponry. Oh, I would say I was a medic, but I was not a conscientious objector. I was trained on a number of different weapons, all of which I can barely hear now, but all of that noise contributed to hearing loss and tinnitus in my case. So, you know, I was there pretty much the whole time that I was in Vietnam. I left once, flew out of Da Nang for R&R, went to Malaysia for R&R. But other than that, I was in the field there for 11 months.
So speaking of R&R, we're going to do a little R&R of our own, but it comes in the form of a radio identification spot here. So you are listening to KCIW LP, Curry Coast Community Radio, 100.7 FM in Brookings, Oregon. And as a radio station, we are a nonprofit operated primarily by volunteers. And if you're interested in helping out, please get in touch with us over our Facebook page. It's a great group of people to hang out with. So, and now back to the program, Our Veteran Community, continuing on with Hank Cunningham. He has just gotten back from R&R. So how many months do you have left on your tour after your R&R?
I think I had about 90 days and a wake-up, they called it. That's what they would call it. When you got down to 30 days, you would get a short-timer stick, and you'd get to carry that around and wave it at the other ones and laugh at them.
It was like a nana-nana-nana.
I don't know how many people got to the short-timer stick,
yeah.
And that was it. They'd have to go out on a search-and-destroy mission. They didn't come back.
Yeah.
So I had an opportunity towards, it was during my last 30 days, where I could have extended in country there and then got an early out, been separated from the Army right there in Vietnam. but kind of like the opportunity, quote unquote, of going to officer candidate school, I politely turned that down and said, I'll go home. And I had to do an extra 3 months. But during that point in time, when I, between R&R and getting out of Vietnam, that's where I earned the combat medic badge. And it's interesting how they do that. Ray has one also. They know the exact coordinates of where you were, what battle you were in, and all this. It's not something they just give away because right. you happen to be in Vietnam or any other country. They still award the combat medic badge. So without going into gory details, I earned my combat medic badge. I made a very good rank in Vietnam. I was up to, they have these pay classifications, like if you're a private, you're an E1.
Right. And
so I was promoted to E5, which is the equivalent of a buck sergeant, specialist five, and got a combat medic badge and turned down the opportunity of extending there and flew down to Saigon and out of country.
So you got to fly home at least. You didn't have to do another ship thing.
No, didn't have to do a ship on the way back.
Right.
And I still call them boats, which drives Navy people crazy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I do it almost to taunt them.
Yeah, exactly.
That was the last
one. So you were telling a short story before we started recording the program. You hit San Francisco in December.
Oakland,
in December. And you are dressed for humid, tropical weather.
Yeah.
So that must have been a real shock to the system.
Yeah, one other thing, just a quick aside.
Okay.
The reason I left then is we kind of knew the Tet Offensive was coming, and that was another reason why I wanted to get out of there as quickly as I could.
Sure.
We knew there was going to be a big battle, and it kept getting worse, and it was worse after I was there. My unit, the 11th Armored Cav, then I'm told, or I've read, convoyed back down into, back to Swan Lock where I started, which is not too far from Saigon, and they were in some really big battles. There were like 6 or 7 Medal of Honor winners in my unit, again, after I had left country. So anyway, I didn't have to go through that, although I really feel for those who did.
Yeah.
But so we fly back, first landed in Honolulu, and had these little short sleeves, and I weighed about, you know, I weigh 235 pounds now. I weighed about 160, 65 pounds then. And so you can imagine what I was like a skeleton. We land in first in Honolulu and just spent very short time there and then wound up in Oakland. And I had these little, I don't even remember what they're called. They're dress uniform, but very lightweight. And they were tan, light tan color. And got off the airplane in Oakland. And I thought I was so cold. And here I had grown up in the Northwest,
right.
You know, in Seattle.
Right.
So, I was not, I could deal with some cold, but not like that. Not after having been a year in country, taking malaria pill. I never got malaria, which I'm thankful for. But you had to take malaria pills every day and salt tablets, and you're constantly sweating.
Yeah.
It would rain so hard that you could basically take your steel pot outside, fill it up with water, and bathe, filling up the steel pot with water.
Right.
At least it was
a clean source of water compared to what you could get typically over there.
Oh, yeah. You didn't want to drink the water there. The beer was okay.
Yeah.
Tiger beer, these big...
I remember Tiger beer.
Tiger beer, mainly.
Interesting stuff.
Anyway, so I was back, and that was kind of a shocker in terms of readjustment. Nobody ever spit on me or anything like that. That's all bull, as far as I'm concerned. I don't believe it. I wouldn't say... I thought they were leery of me. And I was afraid of being seen as like a crazy Vietnam vet, but... People would kind of look askance. I felt maybe they didn't. But nobody, I was not disrespected in any overt
Well, you're fortunate, way. Yeah.
Yeah, and then that's when I started college.
Yeah.
On the GI Bill.
Cool. And what was your major?
Well, at first I went to community college. That's right. Why I'm a big supporter of community college. And SWOC, I think, does a great job here. Where my wife and I were just at an event up in Coos Bay on the main campus for mm-hmm. SWOC. So having the GI Bill, and I'm also a big fan of VA. VA has helped me throughout my adult life, even though and they weren't responsible for me being in Vietnam.
Right.
I started college then. I went to junior college first and took general studies. My intent was always to transfer to a four-year school so mm-hmm. I could be like the rich kids in the high school that I went to. I'll show them. I can be a college graduate, yeah. too. I did 2 years there in community college in Seattle, and then I transferred up to Western Washington in Bellingham and completed a bachelor's degree there. And then I even went on from there. I started grad school at the University of Washington, which I never could have gotten into UW. Out of high school, for sure.
Oh,
forget
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
You know, but by the time you've shown that you can be a good student in junior college, which is one of the really important things I think that community college does, mm-hmm. is it takes people that were on a path to driving a truck or whatever. Not that there's anything wrong with that. Took people from one path and gave them an opportunity
sure.
To go to a four-year school.
Yeah, it was a proving ground that you could apply yourself and you know, do your coursework successfully.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you were a safer bet for the four-year schools after right. something like that.
So, yeah, so I graduated bachelor's at Western Washington. And then eventually my 20s were kind of a lost period. Some people, I mean, I did come out of my 20s with a master's degree. Mm-hmm. I would say that. But I was not, some people, you know, like Ray went into police work and they really used their Army experience as a stepping stone, I think, to a good career. Well, I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
That was the late 60s, early 70s, and, you know, I was more interested in other unproductive activity.
And we shall leave that there for the mind to wander.
My hero or whatever in those days was John Kerry. And
okay.
Vietnam Veterans Against the War.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have a great deal of respect for him, and I can't believe what they did to him. I mean, he's a legitimate hero. He didn't have to do that. He didn't have to be there. He could have had every deferment mm-hmm. in the world, but he didn't. Following that route, then I eventually I had moved to California.
Right.
And I completed a master's degree down.
Right. Now, how were you supporting yourself during this period of time?
Jobs. I've always worked.
Yeah.
You know, I drove trucks. I remember driving a fuel oil truck.
Okay.
And I had GI bills, so I kind of continued in college up to the point that I had part of a master's degree and then moved down to California and finished my master's degree to Long Beach State.
Okay.
So my career then after that was in local government. Given an opportunity, you know, most of us who are halfway smart can succeed at just about anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I worked my way up in local government, worked for a number of large cities, not small towns. Brookings is the first small town I've ever lived
okay.
in.
Yeah.
So that's kind of new to me, but I worked my way up and retired as a department director from City of San Diego, and that was about 10 years ago. And then I worked for a couple of years for Bank of America after that, and I would have never had the qualifications for that job had mm-hmm. I not gone to college. And,
right.
But there's colleges can be a different route for different people. I think there's a lot of technical degrees and vocational
sure.
and so on.
Oh,
It's not all things. Another thing that's not going to say it's not all things to all people. Another thing that's not all things to all people are veterans.
Mm-hmm.
We run the gamut.
Sure.
There's all kinds of different people who are veterans. I've always been, I guess you would say, on the liberal side.
Okay.
And I'm not ashamed of that.
Okay.
And I haven't been a big joiner, so I'm not involved with the local Vietnam veterans mm-hmm. group here. Went to one of their meetings. It didn't really do it for me, but more power to them. There are a lot of different kinds of veterans around.
Having been hanging around them for a number of years, absolutely.
My first thing I would ask, were you a combat veteran?
Hmm.
And we are a lot different, I think, than those who weren't in combat.
Sure, absolutely. Your experience shapes who you are, how you think, how you react, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So, that's really neat. So you got into city government, and you actually came out relatively unscathed. I don't see any lasting, wounds or anything like that, because a lot of time working in the public sector, especially around cities and potential politics, can be a little bit hairy.
Well, I didn't realize that all this time I was really suffering from PTSD. And so what career do I pick? If there's anything that's crazy making, it's working in city government.
Yeah.
Where you're trying, particularly the kind of job I had, which was sort of a go-between between the politicians and the bureaucrats. And I wasn't, I will never run for public office, and I would never be seen, I never was seen as a bureaucrat.
Right, right. Yeah, I bet you had your moments of frustration.
but I stuck it out. I mean, the alternative wasn't good. I made good money, and mm-hmm. I have pensions.
Good benefits, right.
Of pensions, and, but I didn't know the whole time I was suffering from PTSD, I'm sure.
Okay, now, so this is going to kind of, dovetail in here. Where along this life trail that you've explained so far, did you meet your wife?
Which one?
Oh, well, we can go back to the first one and kind of carry on.
PTSD is not good for...
No, it's not.
The first one was right after I got back from Vietnam, and that didn't last maybe a year and a half. No children, thankfully.
Yeah.
Then I was single for 6-7 years, I think, and then I was married to the same woman for 31 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm on marriage number 3 now. I call it my forever marriage, and we've been married for 6 years.
Very good.
We've lived here we've owned a place here for 6 years.
Right.
But it was a second home. We had another place in Portland. We like Brookings so much and Curry County that we sold the place in Portland.
Right.
So I've got grandkids up in Portland. My wife has grandkids here, and they're in Gold Beach, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But,
So how did you meet your forever wife?
I can't think of the name of it. It's one of those computer, not eHarmony, the other one.
Match.com?
No, eHarmony, not Match.
Not Match, but eHarmony.
eHarmony, yeah. And we actually are a success story for eHarmony. And they do a very extensive job of finding out who you are mm-hmm. and so that they're not mismatching people. So, and I think, I speak highly of that.
Good.
Yeah, we were a good match. Yeah. Are a good match.
Are a good match, right. Cool deal. I look forward to possibly meeting her someday at one of my band's forays, maybe over at Chetco Brew or something like that. So that would be fun.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So, sold your place up in Portland, and you're down here now full time, right?
Yep.
Cool deal. So what have you discovered about this community that you really like and you really absolutely drives you crazy?
Well, it's a beautiful natural environment, number one. And it's got a good social scene. You know, I mean, you're a musician, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Right. So, yeah, we really like all the local spots, Coon Tai and Oxenfree, where mm-hmm. we can hear live music. And there are some incredible musicians around here. We were quite pleasantly surprised that you can go out and hear some really good musicians.
Yeah.
And so we like that, like the natural environment. My wife is on the advisory board of SWOC. She actually retired from SWOC some years ago, about the time we met. But she had worked up in Coos Bay at the main campus. So we are supporters of SWOC. In fact, that's where I was for my exercise class.
Right, yes.
And I think I'd like to see the community take more advantage of SWOC, and whether it be going more of a technical vocational route or as a college for your college transfer, I think it's a real benefit to this community. It's the smallest and most conservative community I've ever lived in, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. My career in city government, I worked for a lot of Republicans, right. No problem with that.
Right.
It's a little bit right. I'm not a far left type person anyway. I don't think anybody who's a veteran could be categorized that way. But yeah, I hope to see a meeting of the folks that live here so they get along better, and it's not just Republican versus Democrat.
Right. I think if we focused our conversations about the things we have in common versus the things we have different.
Absolutely.
We would be really surprised to notice how close most of us are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm technically not even a Democrat. I'm an independent.
Right, but, right.
Yeah, you know. So anyway.
I'm a libertarian, so, you know, it's like.
Well, yeah, like that. Yeah, I'm not a libertarian, but I'm unaffiliated.
Right.
It's like my dog tag.
You're not a joiner. We already know that.
It's like my dog tag in the Army. You know, you'd have your Catholic or whatever, or no preference. I was a no preference.
Yeah. Crazy.
I have that dog tag somewhere. I'll have to dig it up.
So for a lot of the same reasons, I really like this community. You know, you have expressed that. What are some of the, I'll use the term negative, but, you know, less than attractive aspects of Brookings when it comes to, like, services? I know you're not in this VA district. You're still up in the Portland area, in
right.
White City. So, but, you know, as far as, like, services, beauticians, car repair, dentists, all that kind of stuff. I mean, what have your experiences been?
Well, I think with medical care, it's always a matter of working the system. I just stuck with Portland VA because all my doctors are up there. And the only reason I was at White City is, ironically, somewhat as it turns out, White City is the center for the whole state for PTSD.
Yeah, they have a psych section over there. Yeah.
I didn't realize that. And, you know, I had applied for disability pensions for other things, Agent Orange, hearing loss, tinnitus, and it's hard to establish a service connection.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went there. Every county, Curry County has one, you know, Washington County or Multnomah County have. Each county has what's called a veteran service
right.
officer. And that person doesn't work for VA. They're kind of a go-between or a liaison
exactly.
with VA. Mm-hmm. So I was a little frustrated because I'd been turned down. I thought if anything, I would get it on hearing loss, you know, mm-hmm. get a 10% disability so I didn't have to pay copays on my meds and so on. I would say also as a medic, I was positive, never sick, but I tested positive for hepatitis C.
Mm.
And another thing VA did for me is get me to the front of the line when all these new medications for Hep C came out.
Nice.
And literally cured me of that disease. I was never sick, but probably would have been eventually. So anyhow, met with a VSO in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And I expressed my frustration that I wasn't able to get just a small pension just so I didn't have copays on drugs. And he said, you know, you really should apply under PTSD. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. Because it used to be my job in some of these forward base camps making the decision whether somebody went out on a search and destroy mission or out
right,
in the field.
Whether they were combat.
It would be up to me, and sometimes they didn't come back.
Yeah.
And that was a pretty awesome and frustrating responsibility. So I didn't want to apply under PTSD. He says, well, you want to get a pension? Well, I'd like to. He said, trust me, given where you were and what your job was, your MOS,
mm-hmm.
yeah, you'll probably, all probability, you'll get approved under that.
How long did that take from application to final
Well, I'd
award?
Been trying for 10 years just to get a little 10% on the hearing or... Right. or Hep C or Agent Orange, all of which I had been exposed to. And without, I started down in San Diego, and without any luck. This process, once this guy said, you know, you really ought to apply under PTSD, it took a year, maybe. And then I saw the hearing officer, who was a psychologist at White City, and he called me up and said, well, we got these openings, these certain dates, and you want to come in? I said, well, I'll tell you, I don't want to waste your time or my time because I've been through this before. And ironically, he had been a medic in the Army, this psychologist.
Interesting, yeah.
He said, no, won't waste your time. He said, I really think you should come in and talk to me. And I did, and within a very short time, I was approved.
Yeah.
You know, I don't feel any shame about saying that I have PTSD, nor that I qualified for a pension.
Right. You know, we're actually pretty lucky in this area as compared to some of the larger metropolitan areas. It's fairly timely here. Fairly.
Yeah, it was quick.
Yeah. You know, so it's like I'm going. And most of the veterans I run into have positive things to say about their experience with the VA. It doesn't always work out to how they think it should, but at least they're not getting lost in the process. And then we've got a couple that complain about everything, so.
I think it's great that we have a small VA satellite here.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, other than I dropped in there once and they gave me some good information. Mm-hmm. I know nothing about Roseburg VA, so I don't have an opinion on that. I know some people have negative opinion about Roseburg. I don't, because I don't know. Right. I have a very positive opinion of Portland VA. So they do a really good job.
Yeah, yeah. And I've had several veterans that have gone through the Oregon University up there. Associated with Portland VA Hospital.
OHSU?
Yeah, OHSU, yeah. It's an amazing facility.
Oh, they're physically connected.
Yeah.
That's why.
And they trade back and forth you know, personnel, which is really nice.
So I have Medicare as well as VA medical. So, yeah, the doctors collaborate there and the buildings are actually physically connected.
Yeah, so. Definitely. So we're down to our last few minutes of the interview here. What would you like to see change about Brookings?
I'd like to see a little more openness from City Hall. You know, a lot of people live here. They're not all the same. They're not all natives of town here. Right. There's Californians. There's people from all over the country here. And I would like to see that reflected in the attitudes and actions of the city council.
Okay.
And the board of, we call them board of supervisors, my government experience is commissioners, board of commissioners, although ones I've met are very nice. City council members I've met are very nice.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I just like to see a little bit more openness to different types of people who now live here and are bringing their dollars, whether it be retirement money or not, investing in this community. We're all residents, we're all here together.
We all have a seat at the table, so to speak.
Exactly.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah, and that's good. All right. That's like from somebody who's worked in the city government sector. I think that's a fair, you know, overview.
I think the city's well run. I have no complaint in terms of you know, the physical aspects of city government. I think it's well run.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the potholes are filled, and you know. But I think it could be a little more open to different ideas.
New ideas, yeah. Ideas that have come from other life experiences.
Right.
Yep, I agree with that. You got to keep your mind open. That's the way growth and progress happens. Yeah. So,
it's a small town.
It is.
Realize, and I'm not a small town. I'm a big city guy, basically. But I love it here. I love being retired here. And we're here to stay.
So do you guys ever find yourself jonesing for a shopping trip to Portland or San Francisco from time to time?
Portland, yeah, because I have grandkids there.
Ah, cool.
And I find I hardly ever get up to Seattle anymore, which I'm hard to believe. But, you know, we're about halfway between Portland and San Francisco here. So we do a lot of driving trips down into California and visit old friends of mine all the way down to San Diego.
But, nice.
It's a perfect place to be.
Yeah, it really is. It's off the beaten path, so to speak. It's a lot slower pace of life. People will wave and smile at you, even if you don't know them, which is really cool.
People are very friendly, and you get to know everybody. You're talking about, you know, where you get your haircut or the waiters, waitresses at local restaurants, and it's just really cool. I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Hank, this has been a wonderful hour that we've spent together. I feel like I've gotten to know you more as just an individual in the community, and now hopefully I'll be able to see you out and about when some of my bands are playing.
Count on that.
Yeah. So, again, thanks for listening to KCIW LP Radio 100.7 FM from Brookings, Oregon. This show will be aired probably within the next week or so, and you can also access our shows through the podcast, and there's apps for that on your smartphone. If you don't have a smartphone, you got a computer, so you can get to it that way too. So anyway, this is Jim Newman signing off for another session. Thanks.
The opinions expressed here were those of the individual participants. Curry Coast Community Radio takes no position on issues discussed in the program.